Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. From the Arts Desk, the group Kansas plays at the Honeywell Center in Wabash on April 21st. April 22nd, it's Mary Poppins at Muncie Civic Theater. The Anderson Symphony Orchestra has Time for Three on April 23rd. Also on the 23rd, Night at the Opera with the Muncie Symphony Orchestra. April 24th, the Manchester Symphony Orchestra is at the Honeywell Center. April 30th, the Honeywell Center has Rain, a tribute to the Beatles. And also on April 30th, the Richmond Symphony Orchestra has Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Had a nice visit with the Association of Lifelong Learners and Dale Hahn in Muncie recently, talking about Indiana Weekend and one of our favorite topics, which is using some of the basic audio tools, like even your phone, to preserve family memories. If you'd like a speaker for your group to talk about the media, public broadcasting, maybe using some of that new technology, drop me a note or look me up at the university. Had the chance to speak to Rotary, the Exchange Club, the Chamber, various places around the listening area. Glad to visit with your group, too. Just give me a call. A Ball State professor invited to the White House to talk about the nation's water quality is reminding us that threats to the water supply aren't so easy to see. Lee Floria and colleague Adam Cuban have led students in a project called Water Quality Indiana to test the health of streams in our region. So how did that lead to Washington?
So to be honest, we didn't really plan on this, right? And this apparently is a very regular thing that happens at the White House. I think earlier this week we heard about the nuclear summit that was going on. And so they have these summits all the time. They just so happened to put out a call in January for individuals and institutions that were doing work with water. I was actually on a different research grant in Florida with three students, and I'm standing, you know, almost on the edge of the mangroves near Biscayne Bay in Miami, and I look at my email and it says, you know, White House, and I open it up thinking it's spam, right? You know, and it says, you know, this is the Office of Science and Technology. We'd like to set up a phone call with you. It was a very good conversation. You know, what they were looking for is, you know, groups, people, individuals, and institutions that are taking actions, measurable actions over long term, to help our water quality across the nation. And they wanted to feature many of those groups and institutions at a summit to coordinate with the United Nations World Water Day.
Of the work that you've been doing, what was it that attracted their attention?
That was certainly a question I asked myself, because like I said, you know, we didn't think what we were doing was that terribly, you know, broad scope, national level. I think we agree that, you know, Adam and I, that what we're doing with the students is excellent, and it's what we should be doing with all students, is getting them out and engaged in the community, in the field, learning sort of experientially for their career.
And let's get caught up with that.
Yeah.
You and Adam Cuban have been looking at local rivers in Indiana. Talk about that just a little
bit. Yeah, absolutely. So we started this project in 2012 collaboratively and taught the first class in 2013 as an immersive learning course on this campus, where we bring students from several disciplines. I think with that first iteration, we had six different majors represented. And in the second iteration in 2014, I think we had four or five majors represented, most of which clustered in sort of the media side and the STEM, or science, technology, engineering, mathematics side of the university. And so the goal is to bring those groups of students together collaboratively so that they one aspect is so that they gain an appreciation of what other students do in their major, but also because none of these students, whether they're from STEM fields or media fields, often get out right in the thick of environmental work in the field, in the water, in the rivers, collecting samples. And, you know, I in another part of my life, I actually work with consulting corporations, both you know, through what I do at the university, you know, training students, but also independently through working with a professional licensure for a state geologist. And one thing that we hear very commonly from these consulting companies is that we really would like students coming out of institutions of higher learning knowing practical skills about you know how to collect a water sample properly so that we don't have to teach them that as part of their job training, so that they understand protocols for proper transport, measurement, analysis, and interpretation of samples. Again, so that it sort of lightens the load of what they have to do as in terms of on-the-job training. And this is very, you know, this is practical skills, but it's also very important for them to see the connection to what their degree provides to them in terms of career pathways.
That must have been a great experience for these people. It's you go from the classroom to the riverbank.
Yeah. And that is literally what we do. We take them out and we get them out on the riverbank and we get them in the water collecting samples. It's something certainly for the media-oriented students that they never thought that they would do. I think it's a big eye-opener. And, you know, from Adam Cuban's side, when he describes this to his colleagues, it is very much a, we see on the news environmental reporting that happens. And in many cases, that information, let's say whether that's about changing climates, changing temperatures, you know, weather forecasting, environmental crises that are happening across the nation, it's often filtered down through a media lens in such a way that sometimes the information is not as well represented as we in the sciences would like to do it, but many of us in the sciences are afraid to do that.
That's a very polite way of saying they often don't know what they're talking about, right?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time, and I know many people in press in various capacities, and it's not really that. It's sort of like if I were to go in and decide that I'm going to be a newspaper reporter, you know, one day, and I wouldn't know the right way to go through the notation, editorial methods, publication methods, because it's just not my skill set. It's not what I was trained to do.
Dr. Lee Floria, assistant professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at Ball State, talking about the need for good data on topics such as the safety of our water supply. Coming up, in light of what we've learned from Flint, Michigan, what do we actually know about our water?
Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
My name is Lee Floria. I am a faculty member in the Department of Geological Sciences here at Ball State University. I'm trained, I guess, classically in water resource issues, but I do a wide range of student-based courses.
So water has been very much on the nation's mind recently with what's happened at Flint.
Right.
And people are asking questions now, is my water safe?
We take water for granted very commonly. We turn on the tap and it comes out the faucet. That's not the case in many parts of the world. And so we're very blessed by that in the United States. And we're also blessed with that here in states like Indiana, where we do receive reasonable amounts of rainfall. We don't feel the same stresses that people, let's say, in portions of California where they've had long-term drought, or Texas where they've had long-term drought, feel. I remember living in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, for a few years, it rains 6 months of the year, and then it doesn't rain that much at all for 6 months of the year. And some years when it gets exceptionally dry, they have restrictions on how and when you can wash your car, how and when you can water your lawn. And those seem like very first world problems in many ways. But even so, those small measures, you can feel them because you're not used to them. And so, you know, I think that any time that we highlight the status of our water resources nationally is a good thing. so that we remember not to take it for granted. Unfortunately, sometimes that takes somewhat problematic events like we've seen up in Flint. And you know, Flint is not the only example. It's one that has received national level of attention, which that is a good thing, not what happened. And I think, you know, that can teach us many lessons of how to not repeat such events.
I think the headline in the New York Times was something like, how many Flints are there out there?
Yes, and during this White House summit, there was considerable attention to that, because certainly as part of this United Nations World Water Day, we the people who were there were brought together to highlight various angles of water resources, research, management, and regulation across the nation. And Flint was a major component of that. And one thing that became clear is that, no, Flint is not the only example of that. We have, across the United States, not just in Michigan, aging infrastructure that in many cases contains delivery pipelines that are of a former technology and that require certain care that we take for granted. The concept of these lead-lined pipes or lead-attached pipes seems very foreign to us, but they exist in many places across the United States. And they're reasonably safe if you take care of them properly. But when you don't, which is what happened in Flint, then bad things can happen.
Just from a consumer standpoint, would you have recommendations for people who may be curious about, hey, is the water I drink safe?
Well, certainly as a consumer, I mean, this is a consumer of municipal water supplies, we do a very good job in the United States, just overall. I mean, I travel internationally quite often, and you'll read, you know, don't drink the water. And, you know, even if it's in a high-class hotel, don't drink the water because you can't be sure of the source. That's not necessarily the case in the United States. We have very good control on the source. What we often don't have as good control on is the delivery. And so I think federal regulations are that if you have a municipal water supply, it has to be tested regularly. And that testing is in public. So, for example, here in Muncie, if you have connection to the municipal water, you have access to, whether it's mailed to you or online, you have access to regular testing information on the quality of your water, how much lead, arsenic, all of these other compounds of concern, how much is in that water? And so you as a consumer should, as we all should, take a few moments and find out where that is and read it. And if you don't understand it, ask, because it is worth knowing.
Knowing what you know, do you take any special precautions with your drinking water at home?
Well, I
want to put you on the spot. Well, here.
Right. I've traveled a lot in my life, and so I've always been careful about water simply because I know what can happen when you do take it for granted and consume the wrong water. If you're in another country and you take the wrong sip of water, you can have multiple days of unpleasantness. I mean, I feel fairly safe when I'm in the United States. I would admit, I think like most people, that you don't necessarily consume the water straight out of the spigot all the time. You have your nice little Brita filter or something at the house.
I have one of those, and I feel a little more secure, like right. My little carbon filter's doing something. Is that true? Is it actually helping?
Yes, it is true. It does help. Activated charcoal is an excellent mechanism to strip out some of these contaminants in water. And in fact, that was one of the solutions that they were implementing in the short term in Flint, is to try to filter some of these waters through activated charcoal as a means to eliminate the impurities. So yes, absolutely, it does work. I don't think in many cases we absolutely need it, but I just kind of just do it in general because I'm used to doing it.
Professor Lee Floria from Ball State's Department of Geological Sciences. He's led students in a project called Water Quality Indiana to test the health of streams in our region. If you'd like more information, it's on their Facebook page, or we can connect you with them. Just drop me a note.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
Now, we know just from reading the news that infrastructure issues are a matter of concern across the country, whether we're talking about bridges or highways. Are water systems in this category as well?
Yes, absolutely. And that was another major focus of this White House summit, was whether that were water suppliers that were present, listening and contributing, or whether that were congressional representatives who were making a pitch about the need for additional infrastructure. I think that it's very clear that maintaining the infrastructure is an important part of maintaining sort of that healthy supply of water. And in places like Flint that have older delivery pipes, which Flint is far from the only place that has that. Again, the pipe is only the delivery mechanism, so you've got to maintain it and properly in order to make sure that the product is safe.
I guess what would concern probably a lot of folks, including the parents of small children, is that they might well read a report from their water supplier that says, hey, everything's fine, but you wouldn't know unless you were testing it at your tap or something. Is there anything that people can do to reassure themselves? You know, you imagine people live in older homes or older sections of a city.
That may be a difficult question in some ways, because I've lived in new houses and I've lived in old houses, and I almost have to take it for granted at some level that the city, municipality, county, whoever it is doing the right job. There's only so many hours in a day that we can do things. So I can't sit and worry about it all the time. But as a water person, I do think about it. And so, you know, what I do is I make sure to check, again, those publications about what testing that they do, how often, and what the results are. And, I mean, I might have access to a few different instruments that I can actually test my water on my own, but I don't think that, you know, regular consumers should worry at that level. I think that just, you know, regular precaution, thinking about it, looking it up, and, you know, filtering your water if you feel like you're concerned, particularly if you're in an older neighborhood, older houses, that probably is a reasonable approach.
So you're invited to this conference on water because of the things that you know. What did you learn as you were at this?
For me personally, as I was discussing this sort of debriefing with Adam and others, it was a very interesting experience on several levels. For me, first of all, I had not been to a summit like that. So getting to experience how they function and the purpose of those is, I think, very enlightening, sort of in terms of how our government works. That's I think, very useful for me as a scientist to know how they approach this, how to formulate future grant proposals, the kinds of words and ideas that they're looking for, and how to communicate with that kind of group of people in such a way to make our program a little bit more nationally applicable. So obviously they had interest or they would not have invited. But now that we've sort of got the highlight, if you will, how do we capitalize on that highlight in such a way that we can reach these people with actual tangible products? And I think that will help us in our progress forward in this class that we've been working on.
When thinking about the quality of our water, some people can remember back the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire, when a time 45 years ago when our streams and rivers, in some cases in places like Muncie, were so polluted. Today, the White River in Muncie, for example, much, much cleaner, right? Does that mean that we're finished protecting the river?
No, of course not. I mean, it is everlasting vigilance at some. I mean, when you have a resource that as good as the White River, then you need to make sure through the long term that you're utilizing the best practices to maintain that resource. And, you know, mentioning like the Cuyahoga River, those events are, you know, significant in our history.
Here. Just about led to the formation of the EPA or helped.
Exactly.
Help that,
yeah,
right?
And so you know, even in my classes on natural hazards, I utilize little video clips about the Cuyahoga and sort of explain the process of places like the Love Canal near Buffalo and how those that happened. Post-World War II industrialization over the course of a couple of decades have led to the creation of the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and other major regulatory authorities that we as a nation use under NEPA, which is this National Environmental Policy Act, to help maintain our natural resources as a nation. And so I think that at least some level of education by everybody of why those exist and why we have them and how we implement them would really help sort of the broader populace understand why and why we do what we do. And so, you know, bringing that back to the places like the White River, absolutely, it is much better than it was. And in part, it is much better than it was in the 70s and the 80s because of actions that came through the EPA and the Clean Water Act. But that doesn't mean that that's over. I mean, we have agricultural concerns, and that's, you know, a big focus of what we do for this water quality class.
And CSOs.
And absolutely CSOs, which, you know, in many towns are starting to be fixed. Like here in Muncie, they're investing quite a bit of money to redevelop our sewage system to prevent that from happening. It's a long-term goal. And Muncie is, you know, one of many cities that's having to go through that.
Up on Cripple Creek, and she sends me in my spring a leak, and she bids me, I don't have the speed, she defends me.
Lee Floria, assistant professor of geological sciences at Ball State, a water scientist leading students in an immersive learning project called Water Quality Indiana with his colleague, Professor Adam Cuban. You may remember a report 2 years ago said Indiana has the worst water pollution of any state. The group called Environment America in 2014 reviewed data from the EPA's Toxics Released Inventory. It said across the country, industrial facilities dumped 206 million pounds of toxic chemicals into U.S. waterways in 2012. Indiana alone accounted for more than 17 million pounds. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management took issue with the study, calling it misleading. But a spokeswoman did say the state does need to do better when it comes to water quality. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.